History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Philadelphia is often referred to as the birthplace of the United States, but it'd also be fair to say it was the birthplace of American espionage. Today's guests are Keith Melton and Bob Wallace, and they're the author of the new book, Spy Sites of Philadelphia, where we're going to discuss the city's secret history from the nation's founding to the present. Throughout the Revolutionary War, Patriot leaders included intelligence operations as a crucial element of the new government. George Washington was America's first spy master, and he deployed his agents to overcome the advantages of the British force. After the war, spy activity centered around the city's port facilities and manufacturing plants. As political, diplomatic, and economic activity shifted from Philadelphia to New York and Washington, the city remained a target first for Chinese and Soviet industrial spying, and later for Islamic jihadist recruitment operations. And interestingly enough, a lot of the laws that we have today in the United States about espionage have to do with Germany trying to recruit German Americans into spycraft and espionage in the First World War and the Second World War. And it's really hard to overstate the importance of espionage during many points in America's history. In the Revolutionary War, George Washington used espionage effectively to offset the overwhelming numerical superiority of the British and Hessian forces. And Philadelphians from all social classes, all economic classes have taken part. There were bankers, best-selling authors, scholars of classical literature, historians, nationally known scientists, journalists, engineers, and people from lower classes as well who took part in espionage. So this is a big slice of American history focusing on one city. There's really a lot to uncover here. So I hope you enjoy this discussion with Keith Melton and Robert Wallace. Keith and Robert, welcome back to the show.
Good morning.
Scott, good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the last time we talked, it was only 11 months ago. Although it felt like an eternity ago in the reverse dog years of coronavirus lockdown. And we looked at spy sites of New York, and now we're going to focus on spy sites of Philadelphia, which I've looked at spycraft at different times in this podcast in the past, so I'm really going to enjoy this topic. So let's start off in general. When it comes to doing spycraft in, let's say, the 18th century, how do you do spying in the 18th century? What are approaches that, based on your research, seem to work?
The 18th century was a time, I think, of great transition for spies. This was a period of time when we started to see some significant advances in technology that really carried over until today. And so I like to see it as a transition period. It was both a time of traditional spying, some of the kinds of secret writing and binoculars, telescopes that we had at the time of the American Revolution, and those began to be transformed then in the following century during the Civil War. Keith?
I would observe that the fundamentals of espionage, the goals, always remain the same. You want to get information that's hopefully privileged. You want to be able to get information the bad guys don't know that they've lost, and you want to protect your own information. The only thing that fundamentally changes is the available technology. And as Bob pointed out, General Washington certainly understood the necessity and the asymmetrical warfare advantage that espionage would give him, and he elicited the best available technology, which was primarily more in covert communications and secret writing, though they did start to collect more using binoculars. But it's interesting how it became so important and ultimately played an important role in the success of the revolution.
Well, right. And before getting into specific sites, I'd love to hear about technology that you came across. I have looked at this a little bit. The author of the book, Washington Spies, was on this podcast before, and things like writing on hard-boiled eggs and taking off the shell and you could see messages. But what were some of the technology that stood out to you as you were looking at this topic?
I thought one of the important technologies that really extended until the 20th century was the Jefferson cipher machine, which was new for the time, was a different concept in how you might encipher information. Keith?
The focus was at that point in their evolution of technology was more on, from my observation, on how they could, how do you could truly communicate secretly. One of the first colonial committees was the Committee for Secret Correspondence. And so they understood that upon secrecy, so much would depend. And the focus for much of what General Washington did was you could have agents embedded that would collect information, but you still had to find a way to get it back where it could be successfully processed and utilized. And so the focus was on what they called sympathetic stains, which we would refer to as secret inks. And inks always have one formula for the ink, but then you'd need a separate formula for the reagent to make it visible so you could see it. And there was quite some complexity in the inks. We are still somewhat uncertain on the formula of some of them. But if you combine that with early versions of book codes, which were set numbers that were used to replace words or identify people, though they didn't change them often enough, it made it quite complex if anyone was able to, number one, intercept the message, but then find out a way to develop the ink and then try to decipher what they found. So I see the greatest focus in that one area.
Scott, concealments were also a critical element of secret communications. And so in the Philadelphia Spy Sites book, we have an example of one of the spies, Ma Rinker, using bolts, knitting bowls, balls of knitting yarn as the means for concealing the messages that she was being passed. A more common way of concealment would be using the secret writing and embedding that in personal letters or in invoices that would be exchanged between merchants, but embedded within those documents would be the secret writing.
I'd love to hear about the type of people who are engaging in spycraft. And in the previous episode, when we looked at New York, we mentioned things like the Culper spy ring. And what's great about that is the people involved are people who were effective at gathering intelligence, largely because they were overlooked. You had a woman who ran a tavern, you had a slave. They're the people who are, they form the background of life, but those who are in high positions of power, they treat these figures like wallpaper. So they're very loose-lipped around them, and they don't think, oh, the slave is hearing what I'm saying, and she's simply going to pass along that information. Sadly, in the popular consciousness, spycraft has forever been ruined by James Bond, where you have a man who is working under his real name and announcing it loudly to people and being as loud and flashy as possible. But helping out the world and your nation usually doesn't involve taking down space lasers and henchmen with underground volcano layers. It's working subtly and behind the scenes and not getting noticed. And you mentioned those people in New York. Who are the type of people who gathered intelligence and were engaged in spycraft in Philadelphia?
I would observe that they were essentially, at that point in history, we didn't have a professional intelligence cadre, where the opponents, England, had an established history of espionage going back to Walsingham and earlier. So they drew on people that were familiar, trained, and understood the craft. It was a combination of self-taught or a holdover from British citizens or individuals pressed into service who began to do very unusual things in support of the colonials. And I see it, with the exception of the overall organizers, it was more function-based. It was common that a house could be used to support, to house British soldiers. Well, over dinner or in the in the drawing room, there'd be a conversation between two officers. So if you could eavesdrop on what they said, you might get some insight on what may be planned. I think there was a general unawareness of how vulnerable information was and how some small bits of information can be aggregated, even if it's tips on so-and-so's needs winter clothing or these are their plans. Ultimately, if it were you collect enough small bits, it could be very useful to General Washington.
I think one of the elements that surprises me a little bit, and we saw that see this both in the Revolutionary War as well as the Civil War, is how fluid the lines were between the opposing forces. And so people could move back and forth with across lines with relative ease. When Philadelphia is occupied by the British, the Philadelphia citizens could move outside of the city, get to Valley Forge or in those areas, seemingly without really serious searching or having to go through major checkpoints. So that fluidity with the population was an important element in Washington receiving information. In fact, it worked the other way as well. You know, the people, there were spies reporting to the British.
Huh. How is Philadelphia compared to New York and decades after the Revolutionary War, Washington, D.C., in terms of espionage? Is it a hotbed of espionage in the way that these other two cities are?
I would observe that if you look at, as Bob and I have looked at American cities and that would merit books, the three essential centers of espionage for much of our democracy have been New York City, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C. There is almost no other cities that have the concentration of espionage, either for sabotage, collection. Those were the dominant cities in our history. And if we speak, of course, to Revolutionary War, it would be Philadelphia and New York City. So there's no other cities comparable to them, in my observation.
In researching the book, the Philadelphia prominence during the First World War, the interim period between the two wars, and the Second World War struck me as a real surprise. This Philadelphia, and to a large degree because of the German population in Philadelphia that had origins in Germany, that made the city particularly significant. It was significant both as a place where the German intelligence service launched significant propaganda operations. Philadelphia was a target for German sabotage during that time because of its manufacturing capability. And in fact, the German population provided for German intelligence a basis for recruiting spies. That wasn't lost on the British either. And so as a result, the British had several operations in Philadelphia designed to blunt whatever intelligence work the Germans were doing there. The United States recognized this as well. And interestingly, the Espionage Act of 1917, which is still used today, was really built around the need, the perceived need to protect against German intelligence rather than any other country.
Huh. Yeah, I'm curious about that, especially with German propagandists in World War II, then Soviet agents are also in the city. Could you tell me about some of these figures?
Several interesting points have come up. The high water mark of Soviet espionage in the United States is still remembered to be in that late 1930s, just prior to the Germans and Russia signing the Mutual Non-Aggression Pact. And suddenly that was a bombshell to the Soviets because they had recruited heavily among Jewish Americans, believing that if they recruited them, they would be striking a blow against Germany. However, once that took place, it marked probably ultimately a complete transition away from the ideological recruitments and more to just trying to buy secrets. But there has been a heavy history. We found in ultimately the KGB files, they had identified certain locations in major cities that were useful for meetings, clavas. And there were a couple locations that we show. I believe my memory is in movie theaters were used in Philadelphia. There were significant individuals such as Harry Gold that we talk about in the book that was one of the key runners and intermediaries between individuals involved with stealing the atomic secrets in World War II and getting those back to the Soviets so they could indeed get them, process it, and get them back to Russia. And Harry Gold played a very pivotal role in that. One last one that I think was a surprise to both Bob and ourselves that's only been discovered recently was an infiltration into our Manhattan patent project, which was the developing of the atomic bomb in World War II. And they had distributed the sites where they were working on making the bomb around the country. And one was a secret facility inside the Philadelphia Navy Yard. And the agent's code name was Delmar. And he was never previously identified. And his real name was Koval. And ultimately, he was only outed in 2006, I believe, when he finally passed away at age 92. And Mr. Putin in Russia decided to give him a posthumous award for his great contributions to intelligence during that period. And so we both learned about him, learned about his successful operation, but it also brought to light the site of where this secret facility was on the Navy Yard that we identified.
Yeah, George Koval from Iowa, Sioux City, Iowa. And that's a great point you mentioned because the Jewish communities in America who had been pushed out of Imperial Russia due to the pogroms of the late 19th century, you have a Russian-speaking population. The Soviet Union is making overtures to them that, oh, all that anti-Semitism, that was the Imperial Russia. Now, because of the revolution, because of the Bolshevik Revolution, you will be embraced in Russia with open arms. Some believe this, like George Koval, and actively worked with them. Very successful in what he did, for sure. And like you said, wasn't found until years later. As a very quick aside, I had a listener ask me about the Philadelphia experiment. Wonderful kooky conspiracy theory. Now, I don't know if that ties into your book at all, but since I have two authors of a book on Philadelphia, does that make any mention in your book at all?
The Philadelphia experience Philadelphia experiment does make an entry in our book.
Great. Yeah, can you briefly describe that and then how it figures in your book? It's a wonderful little conspiracy theory.
Well, the Philadelphia experience, I'm sorry, I keep saying experience rather than experiment. The Philadelphia experiment was building the invisible boat, the invisible ship. So if one believes that an invisible ship can be constructed and one wants to give that kind of capability to the United States secret organizations, why then where better place to build it than in Philadelphia? After all, Philadelphia was where we built the Glomar Explorer, which was one of the most famous of the CIA's covert operations in the 1970s as we attempted to recover a Soviet sunken submarine that was carrying nuclear missiles. So the Philadelphia experiment in terms of building ships maybe to a degree comes to fruition in the Glomar Explorer. But I'll let the readers see the full story in the book.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Scott, I'll add just a little bit to that. One of the great challenges the Navy was facing during World War II and World War I also had been floating mines, and these were attracted magnetically to ships. And so there was probably the genesis of the idea of making it visible was really to make it invisible to mines. And it was trying to create a giant degaussing coil that you could make that so the magnetic mines wouldn't be attracted to the ship. And the question was, could you create this invisibility to the magnetic mines for a ship? And there were experiments to try to degauss the entire ship. That laid the foundation for what was later numerous UFO conspiracies that somehow they were going to make the entire ship invisible optically, which was never part. It had been a wonderful goal, but it was never part of the work.
Right. And then it gets to conspiracy theories of teleportation. And I'm sorry, what else are you going to say with that?
I was just going to add, Scott, it's a fascinating piece of the whole business of how technology, though, develops, because, in fact, with these stealth technologies then of the later part of the 20th century, that invisibility to certain kinds of detection does increasingly become a reality. And the CIA also in the 1990s developed the unmanned aircraft, best known now as the Predator. But these also were designed to be invisible visually from about 10,000 feet, given both the design and the coloration and the way they operated. So this idea of having an invisible piece of equipment in your arsenal not only has a history, but also has some reality as we move forward.
So there you go. For something that will forever be associated with Philadelphia, the Philadelphia experiment. And it is an experience, as you mentioned. So teleportation really does work, as some people truly believe. Well, I'd love to look at a couple of sites in your book, but just in general, as you're chronicling different sites, what makes a place a good spy site? Is it an innocuous location where two people could meet? You imagine a bench in a park where someone says, "The crow flies at midnight. The sparrow cannot leave her nest." And then they both leave and they pass along their secret. Is it some sort of inconspicuous place that two people can meet and then depart? Or did you notice any common patterns as you were chronicling these sites?
I would observe that sometimes it's difficult to lump all secret sites into one category, because there is a big difference between a site in which an individual lived or passed away and an operational site. And even operational sites can be a coffee house in Philadelphia in which it was known that British officers drank too much and the staff could simply overhear them boasting about their planned exploits. So that would be an ideal site to collect information. What I believe you're perhaps referring to would be, how do we get a secret site to have a covert meeting? And interestingly, the kind of the rules about how you establish that are essentially intuitive. You want, number one, a site that gives you some privacy, because if you're going to be seen meeting with a person, you probably would not rather do it in private. So it needs to be secret. But it also needs to be accessible. If it's so far away that it takes you hours to get there, it's completely impractical. So it needs to be relatively close, but it needs to give you privacy. You have to have a reason for you to be in the area. You couldn't have it in the midst of the British lines. You have to have you can cover to be there. And if you're leaving something such as a dead drop, you have to have a reason to be carrying whatever it is. And the last condition is it had to be a location that you could actually convey to the other person. So if you, Scott, if you say, well, on that last vacation, I remember on the top of the hill, just over there, that little stream bank by that, where that big tree used to be, That's a spot known only to me. But the problem is you'd never be able to describe it in a way that an agent or the person you're meeting with would ever be able to find it. So these services developed and understood it was much easier to meet in a theater, especially an afternoon show. That was very convenient. So public landmarks easily found were used more often then than they would be today.
Those are the key elements for operational sites. And I think that the ones that we were particularly interested in writing the book were maybe those that were, one, a surprise, or secondly, so obvious that you would never think of them as being used perhaps for operations. The other kind of site that we featured in the book were the sites of where people came from. That is, the people who were involved in espionage. Where did they come from? In that instance, we found significant people in the history of American espionage who were arranged all the way from the slums of Philadelphia to the main line, to the mansions of Philadelphia. That is an instructive piece to me when we think about the history of American espionage. It is like espionage is an equal opportunity employer. Spies can come from anywhere.
Well, that's an interesting point, because if they're not all from, let's say, one economic class, then it's not just about money. For some, it surely was. But if you're from the upper classes, I would presume it's ideological, although it might not be. So what were the reasons that people got into espionage?
I would observe it was far more ideological, and the belief that the oppressive British government and the king, King George, was taxing them unfairly. They had no representation. The remote administrators for King George were often very heavy-handed and saw the colonies as a piggy bank and just generating funds for the wars happening in Europe. And there was unhappiness with that. And ultimately, we see the Boston Tea Party and the Revolution. So though there were individuals who spied for financial gain, it would be largely irrelevant compared to later periods. If you take Benedict Arnold, a name that still survives to this day as one of the great traitors in American history. He died penniless in England in later years. There was no great financial reward that came from his espionage.
The kinds of people that got involved in espionage during the Civil War, many of those had a very strong moral objection to slavery. And as a result, were willing to spy for the Union cause. Mary Bowser is one case in point, that who a black lady from Richmond who was educated in Philadelphia, and then went back to Richmond and worked with another spy, a local spy named Lou. Mary Bowser was employed by the Jefferson White House in Philadelphia and spied. So there was that element, that anti-slavery element that was very strong during the Civil War. Then if you skip forward to the First World War, the ethnic identification, the national identification between the German immigrants and their home country was a very strong motivator.
One site in particular that I think is very interesting, I don't believe we've discussed or only in passing, is Rinker's Rock, which shows how spycraft could work. So could you describe the owner and how she passed on intelligence?
Rinker's Rock is one of those sites that remains in Philadelphia. And Ma Rinker was a knitter, and would take the information that she would acquire from the residents of Philadelphia, put it on small pieces of paper, and then conceal those pieces of paper within the balls of yarn that she was working on sitting on this rock outside of Philadelphia. So here was a nice middle-aged lady just doing her knitting, enjoying the outdoors, sitting on a rock, enjoying the pleasant summers and spring and autumns of Philadelphia. And she would, from time to time, drop a ball of yarn, and this ball of yarn would be concealed, the secret messages or the notes that she had collected from other spies within Philadelphia. Those would be retrieved and then taken to Washington at Valley Forge or whatever location the army was then camped at. Just a clever, very non-alerting kind of way to pass intelligence information.
Right. I mean, it never pays to be too clever by half and come up with an over elaborate solution that someone is going to notice. If it's so low key, nobody would. You're doing your job perfectly. Well, in looking at this book, were there any other things that surprised you as you were researching it? The two of you have mentioned a number of things, but were there any other things that stuck out to you?
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
One thing that Bob and I talked about that history has largely forgotten is the impact of German espionage in the World War I period, 1915 through 1918. We ultimately compiled a list of about 125 major sabotage incidents that took place along the East Coast, in heavily concentration in the ports of Philadelphia and New York, because the Germans, working with the heavy German-American population, were very sophisticated. They ran elaborate intelligence operations. They had sabotage bases, and they were trying to sabotage the flow of supplies from the East Coast to the battlefields in Europe and support of the Brits. And it was an enormous effort that carried on even to World War II. And one of our favorite operations historically is Operation Pastorius, which was the 1942 operation in which 8 saboteurs were dropped in 4 in off Long Island and then 4 off the northeast coast of Florida to conduct sabotage operations. And it was founded, their contacts were all German Americans. Now, one of them went and immediately turned himself into the FBI, and all of them were quickly arrested. But the backbone of their covert communications and their support apparatus was in the Jewish, the German American community at the time.
That's very interesting. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
That German-American community, interestingly, included clergymen in Philadelphia. And our entries about the assistance that two of the German pastors gave to the German intelligence, I thought was especially interesting. I did want to mention, in response to your question, Scott, I think I was struck finally by the reality that, you know, Philadelphia may be the home of American democracy. That may be where our founding fathers exercised their opposition to the British. But in fact, Philadelphia was really first a den of spies. And almost all of these founding fathers had a finger or a hand or an arm or their whole body into the intelligence business, into the espionage business. Running all the way from Ben Franklin to John Jay, who then became the first justice of the Supreme Court. So, in one sense, I might argue that America was founded on the basis of an intelligence conspiracy as much as anything else.
Very good way to put it, and it has been there since the beginning. So that's with the cases that you cited, there's a strong argument to be made there for that. Well, for readers who want to dive in more to the things that we discussed, the name of the book is Spy Sites of Philadelphia, A Guide to the Region's Secret History. So thank you, too, for joining us, and hope to see you again next time.
Thank you, Scott.
All right. That is all for today's episode.
As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Suma 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dan Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.